Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Know ye not, brethren, for I speak to them that know the law, how that the law hath dominion over a man as long as he liveth. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from the law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man.
If you have your Bibles, turn to Romans chapter 7. We will continue our study in the book of Romans this evening. For those of you that are visiting, I've been preaching through the book of Romans. It comes our turn this evening to look at this text. And we're glad that you're here with us to engage in this study with us. If you're visiting with us and can be with us again, I hope you realize that you're always welcome to be among us, and we would love to have you in our presence again. In chapter 6, Paul had argued that the transformative power of the gospel meant that we cannot treat the abundant grace of God as some kind of incentive to sin. Paul had said in chapter 5 that where sin abounded, grace abounded all the more. That God has more than met the problem of sin. He has overwhelmingly conquered it, to use a term that Paul will come up with later on in chapter 8. That he has more than met the problem. That he has not just forgiven us, but he has forgiven us and blessed us on top of that. But of course, there would be some people who would look at that and say, well, where's the justice in that? Where is the punishment for the sinner? What about all of these Bible passages in the Old Testament about the wrath of God? Where is all of that? You're saying that God has just forgiven? That it's all over? That there is no wrath? There is no punishment? There is no final justice? That it's the grace of God that has done away with all of this sin? Why don't we just keep on sinning then, Paul? Isn't that what you're saying? That if I sin, that God will more than forgive, so if I sin more, God will be even more gracious. And Paul said in chapter 6 that no, that doesn't follow. And the reason it doesn't follow is because the gospel, at its very heart and soul, involves a death and a resurrection. Because the gospel of Jesus Christ is about the death of Jesus and his resurrection from the dead. And those who join themselves to Jesus Christ die with him. They join with him in his death in connection or in reference to sin. And they die to sin so that they might live anew, live again. This time not in a mode or a realm of sin, but in a mode of righteousness. Living, not dying. Over sin, not under it, having become new people. And it is for that reason, Paul says, that we cannot live in sin any longer. Paul had said back in chapter 6 in verse 7, using his illustration back there, that he who has died is freed from sin. And in chapter 7, Paul is going to pick up that little statement and expand upon it to bring another consideration into the discussion here. Paul's point is that death creates or results in a freedom. That the basic thing that happens when there is a death is that a relationship is severed. Now, Paul had used that concept back in chapter 6. He said, you died with Christ, and he who has died is freed, therefore, from that old life of sin. You've died to that. You don't have a relationship with that mode of living anymore. You're now free to live a different way. Well, here in chapter 7, Paul is going to interject another consideration, and that is the law. Because the Jews had a problem with this very part of the gospel. Paul, you're saying that if I join myself to Jesus by submitting to the gospel, specifically as Paul talked in chapter 6, by identifying myself with Jesus in the rite of baptism, you're saying that therein lies the problem of sin's solution. You're saying that therein lies what God has done
But Paul, we already had the answer to sin. We had the law of Moses. And those animal sacrifices and the rituals that God gave us, such as those on the Day of Atonement and the myriads of sacrifices that were ordained in the law, don't you realize, Paul, that that's what kept us in fellowship with God? And Paul says here in chapter 7, no, it didn't. And he wants to inform these people, therefore, about just exactly what the law did and what it did not do. And this is a very, very important point. You know, we sometimes tend to look at these discussions about the law as something that really doesn't pertain to us, because none of us obeys the law of Moses. None of us has, as far as I know, any desire to go back and obey the law of Moses. But if I understand what Paul is saying in chapter 7, it's not just about the law of Moses. It's about what the gospel is, and about understanding what the gospel is, and understanding what the gospel is not. And therefore, this chapter is just as relevant to us as it was to those in the first century. Paul here is going to continue his point that death results in freedom, a freedom from domination, a freedom from the law under which someone formerly lived. And in verses 1 through 3 that were read in our hearing a moment ago, Paul uses marriage as an illustration. And sometimes we look at that and we say, why does Paul stop to talk about marriage in this text? Well, the answer is very simple. The marriage relationship is an illustration of the point that Paul is making about death. And Paul says there that you take a woman and her husband, that she is bound to that husband as long as he lives. But if he dies, that relationship is over. That death has severed the relationship, and that woman is no longer bound to that husband. She is, in a sense, to use Paul's language, she is released from the law, from the dominion, from the demand that that husband has over her. Now, if she were to be joined to another one while her husband was still alive, that would be adultery. But if her husband is dead, there is no relationship to violate. And if she were joined to another one after that husband were dead, she would no longer be called an adulteress, Paul says, because that relationship, that former relationship, ended with death. And so Paul makes the application in verse 4. Therefore, my brethren, you were made to die to the law through the body of Christ, so that you might be joined to another, to him who was raised from the dead, in order that we might bear fruit for God. The death of Jesus has resulted in freedom. That's the point Paul's making here, right? That death severs a relationship. Death means that you're free. Well, there has been a death. It has not been my death or your death. It's been the death of the one who was standing in my place and in your place. But a death has happened, the death of Jesus. And you and I, when we became Christians, joined ourselves to that dying, like Paul described in chapter 6, that we were buried with him in baptism into death, so that as Jesus was raised by the power of God to walk in newness of life, so that we should as well. There has been a death. We are no longer bound to walk and live the way that we used to, and that includes living under the law of Moses. That death has rendered us free from the law of Moses. Now, that would have been a controversial point for the Jews, because they thought, of course, that the law was the answer to the problem of sin. But Paul is going to say, now let me tell you what the law did. And he enters now into what I think has sometimes been discussed as kind of a thorny discussion in the book of Romans. I hope to clarify it a little bit this evening, but I don't think it's all that complicated, the point that Paul is trying to make, if we keep things in context here. If you'll notice what Paul says in verse 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Now, who's saying that? Well, that's what people are accusing Paul of saying. They're saying, listen, Paul, here's what you wind up saying. You said in chapter 6 that we joined ourselves to the dying of Jesus, and as a result, we became free from sin. Now you're saying that the death of Jesus has also freed us from the law of Moses. So if you put two and two together, what you are saying, Paul, is that when we were freed from sin, we were freed from the law, that the law and sin were the same thing, that the law is sin. And Paul says, is that what I'm saying? What shall we say? Is the law sin? May it never be. I am not saying that, Paul says. The law wasn't about sin. The law was about righteousness. The law was about goodness. Paul says, on the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. Paul had said back in chapter 3 and verse 20 that through the law comes the knowledge of sin. That's what its purpose was. Now, I wouldn't have known that it was wrong to covet unless God told me that. I would not have known, or a Jew would not have known under the old law, that it was wrong to sow two different seeds in the same field unless God had told him that he didn't want that happening. The Jews would not have known that it was wrong to do the things that they did unless God spelled it out for them. Through the law, God was teaching them that these things are wrong and these other things are right. And so, no, the law has a good and noble purpose to it. But there's something that happened, Paul says, that points out the fundamental inadequacy of the law to deal with the problem of sin. And I want us to understand very clearly that for what happens next here, Paul does not blame the law. And I think Paul tries to be very clear about that. He says there in verse 8 that it was sin taking opportunity through the commandment. And again, he says in verse 13, it was sin in order that it might be shown to be sin that did this thing. We need to be very careful to understand what Paul is and isn't saying. He's not saying that the law created a problem. The law is holy. The commandment is holy and righteous and good. It was for a good purpose. It was given with noble intentions by God. It wasn't the law's fault what happened next. But what happened next was rather interesting. The problem lay with what Paul here calls sin. And it's important that we understand what Paul is talking about when he uses the word sin in Romans chapter 7. Sometimes in the Bible, the word sin refers to that action that is a transgression of God's law. Kind of like what John talks about in 1 John 3 and verse 4, that sin is transgression of the law, or sin is lawlessness. Many times the Bible uses the word sin to describe an action. But here Paul is using the word sin in a little bit different way. Paul is using the word sin here by a figure of speech that is called metonymy, when you put one thing for another, when you put a cause for an effect or an effect for a cause and things like that, when you use a word in a broad and general sense. And when Paul uses the word sin in Romans chapter 7, he's using it to refer to the lust and the rebellious desire of the flesh. He is using this word to describe the rebellious selfishness and pride that is associated with fleshly desire. Because there is a part of every one of us that Paul sometimes calls the flesh. Here in Romans chapter 7, he calls it sin. But whatever you want to call it, there is in every one of us a part of us that wants to do its own thing. A part of us that doesn't want anybody telling us what to do, let alone God telling us what to do. There's a part of us that just wants to please ourselves, to think what I want to think, to do what I want to do, to make myself happy, to make myself feel good, and I don't want anybody telling me I can't or that I shouldn't or making me feel guilty when I do. There's a part of every one of us that is exactly like that. And Paul sometimes, as we said, calls that the flesh. But here his term is sin. And Paul said, here's what happened there in chapter 7 and verse 8, that sin took opportunity through the commandment, and this law that said you shall not covet produced coveting in me of every kind. That sin, lust, desire, selfishness, the flesh, whatever you want to call it, was prompted by the law's mention of sinful deeds. When God said, "You shall not covet," Paul's point is that there was a part of me that heard that and heard the word covet. And there was a part of me that began to think about coveting as a result of that. Now, is that what God wanted to do? Is that what God intended to do? To talk about things just to kind of get me stirred up, to incite my sinful passions by talking about them? Paul says, no, no, no. That wasn't God's doing, and that's not what the law did. That's what this selfish, rebellious part of you did. Because it's always looking for an opportunity to gratify itself. It's always looking for an opportunity to express itself. And when it heard coveting, its ears perked up, as it were. That part of you and me that Paul here calls sin or the flesh perked up as if it had heard its name called and wanted to give attention to that particular sin. I know how this is because I'm a parent, and those of you that are parents know this well, and those of you that were at one point small children probably know this just as well as I do from your own childhood. I remember when I was very young that we had a room in the house. I never understood this, but we had a room in the house. You weren't supposed to touch anything in it. You couldn't go in there. You couldn't sit on the furniture. You weren't supposed to do anything in there. It was for special occasions. And Mom would say to my brother and I, "Don't touch the coffee table in the living room." Well, I hadn't thought about touching the coffee table for weeks until she said something about it. Now, there was a good chance that in playing around the house that I would get into the living room and touch the coffee table, if not get up and stand on it and jump off of it and do all kinds of things like that. And so my mother, knowing how little children are, could foresee that that was going to happen and said, "Here's what I don't want you to do. I don't want you to touch that coffee table." But you know what? It got me to thinking about it. And I remember, I'll tell this story on my brother because he's not here to defend himself. My brother would go up to the coffee table and see how close he could put his hand to it before Mom would yell at him or before she would slap his hand. Now, why was he doing that? It's not like it was fun. It was not like there was some good to be gotten out of touching the coffee table. It wasn't some holy object that imparted goodness or something. No, it's just that he had begun to think about that because of the commandment that he had received. And Paul says that that's what happened with us in the law. That there was this part of us that Paul calls sin that used the law's content to arouse and stimulate and heighten my awareness of sin, and in that sense created a desire for it. This is what Paul means when he says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 56 that the power of sin is in the law. The power of sin is in the law. Because as soon as you mention what is sinful, there is a part of you that wants to respond to that, that wants to do the very thing that was mentioned. And sin gets its power from its exposure to us, and part of the exposure that we have to sin is from the law. Now, again, that's not the law's fault. Because the purpose of the law was God saying, "Here's what I don't want to happen. Here's what you must not engage in." But there is a part of me called the flesh and called sin that wants to pervert things. We noted in chapter 5 that living in sin is a perversion of our purpose. It is a perversion of our existence. That we were not created to live in sin. We were created to live in fellowship with God. And when we live and give our lives to the flesh and to sin and to the indulgence of self and to rebellion against God, we are living in a perversion of what we are for. And it is that perverting effect of lust, that perverting effect of desire, that shows just how corrupt and degenerative it really, really is. You ever tried to have a conversation with someone who just has a dirty mind? And everything you say, they twist it and they pervert it to be some kind of reference to something that is filthy. They find some kind of enjoyment and some kind of amusement in being able to twist your words to say that, oh, you said so-and-so, and that means this. We all have maybe had experience with people like that. Paul is saying there's a part of you that does that to the law of God, that when it hears about lust, it says, yeah, that's what I want to do. When it hears about adultery, it says, yeah, that's what I want to do. When it hears about lying, it says, yeah, that's what I want to do. And it is that perverting effect of sin, Paul says in verse 13, that comes to the fore. So did that which is good become a cause of death for me? Did the law create this problem that made me a worse sinner? May it never be, Paul says. It was sin, perverting the word of God, perverting the law of God, so that it might be shown to be sin. Let's not underestimate the power of sin. And let's not underestimate the power of selfishness and lust and the flesh and physical desire and pride and all of those things that go with it. Because it has an effect on how we think. It has an effect on the judgments that we make. It wants to twist things and turn things to its own advantage. Like a politician that wants to twist the will of the people to some kind of corrupt good for himself, so is the flesh within us. Sin perverted the good law of God, and the result was that I was enticed to sin even more. And so the Jew had come along and said, oh, Paul, the solution to the problem of sin is in the law of Moses. Paul says, no. Here's what happened with the law of Moses. That the sin, the flesh, perverted it and got you actually to thinking about sin more than you had before. And that's not the law's fault, but the law did mention those things. And as a result, you became even more conscious and more wrapped up in sin than you were before. No, the law didn't fix the problem. The law, in a sense, and in a sense I say, the law, in a sense, only made it worse. And so Paul says in verse 14, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. Now the Jew would say, now Paul, you don't understand. If you follow the law of Moses, that would make you a righteous person. Paul says there are three things wrong with that. First of all, nobody ever did that. Paul had established in chapters 1, 2, and 3 that all have sinned, Jews and Gentiles alike. And the Bible itself says so specifically about God's own people, the Jews, in chapter 3, verses 9 and following. All have sinned. This idea that I can follow the law of Moses and be righteous is a theory, because nobody did it. Secondly, the law was not designed to justify the person who had sinned. If you had sinned against God, broken one of his commandments, could the law of Moses make it right? Paul says in Romans 3 and verse 20 that by the law no flesh shall be justified. He says the same thing in Galatians chapter 3. No flesh shall be justified by the law. Why not? Because it wasn't designed to do that. The law was designed to create a sense of guilt, but not to take it away. And thirdly, sin perverted the function of the law so that the sinner did not become more righteous through the law, but the sinner only became frustrated. And that's the point that Paul makes there in verses 14 through 20. He says in these very well-known words in verse 15, "What I'm doing, I don't understand. I am not practicing what I would like to do, but I am doing the very thing that I hate. And if I do the very thing that I do not want to do, I am on one part of me, one level, agreeing with the law, confessing that the law is good, and it is no longer I'm the one that is doing it, but sin which dwells in me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh. For the willing is present in me, but the doing of the good is not. The good that I want, I do not do. I practice the very evil that I don't want. And if I am doing the very thing I don't want, I am no longer the one doing it, but sin which dwells in me." Paul's point is there that sin created an awareness of the need, created an awareness of the need to be righteous. God said so. You must not do this, you must not do that. It told me all the things to stay away from, but it also created a heightened sense of attention towards sin itself. And herein lies the fundamental weakness of the law of Moses. You see, the law addressed the flesh primarily. The law primarily addressed the external part of man. But to change a sinner into a saint requires changing the inside of a man or a woman, not just a redirection of his outward actions. And that is an extremely important thing for us to understand as we talk about practicing Christianity, because it has everything to do with our understanding of what the gospel is and what it does. To put it this way, the law spoke of the need to be righteous. And God spelled it out, don't do this, do that. But all the things that the law directed were basically geared toward the flesh. And the flesh, with its sinful desire, perverted that demand and created within itself the desire to sin more, not less. And so the law, because of its nature, resulted in a situation in which the sinner felt pulled in two opposite directions at the same time. Paul's point in Romans 14 through 20 is that this is what the law of Moses did to me. You know, the question is sometimes raised, who is Paul talking about there? And what part of his life is he talking about? Is he saying that this is how he lives as a Christian? Is this the kind of thing that God has designed for us to be living with as children of God? No. Paul is saying, as long as I was under the law, this is what it was like. I knew that I shouldn't do something, but the sin, the flesh part of me, heard that and wanted to do it. And so my mind said no, but my flesh said yes. And this law that was supposed to keep me from sinning was encouraging another part of me to sin, because the flesh was perverting that message. And I was being pulled in two different directions at the same time. And I was miserable, Paul says. And the reason it was that way is because of the fundamental dichotomy between the flesh and the spirit. Paul says in Galatians chapter 5 that there's the flesh and there's the spirit, and you can't please both. You can't live by both. They are against each other. They are opposite, so that you may not do the things that you please. Paul's going to talk more about that in Romans chapter 8. But the problem with the law is that it directed itself toward the flesh, and it did not have the transformative power that is found in the gospel. And that's the thing that the Jews really didn't see. It is the thing that the Jews who dealt with Jesus surely didn't see, that Paul tried to get his Jewish opponents to see with very little success. You know, the Jews came along and said, "We've got the law. And God gave us the law. He didn't give it to those Gentiles, and we follow the law. Therefore, we are righteous, and they're the ones that are the sinners. And Paul says, no, that's not what's going on. The law wasn't making you righteous. Your obedience to the law is not what was making you the people of God. It was not what was making you right in the sight of God. And therein lies the deception that the Jews were caught in. Because you read how they treated Jesus and they hated him. And when it came time for him to die at their hands, they spat on him. And they gave him to the Romans to torture him to death. And they treated his apostles in very much the same way and persecuted them and stoned them and killed them, all the while saying, we are righteous. And Paul is saying, don't you see the problem? Don't you see that there has been a deception that is wrought here? That the inside of you is not righteous at all? You know, if I could say one thing to those who are the self-proclaimed fundamentalist, radical Muslim extremists, I would probably say what Paul winds up saying to himself in the book of Galatians in chapter 1, that if your religion leads you to hate and to kill and to hurt other people, there's something wrong with your religion. And that is, in a sense, what Paul is saying here, that this law could tell you that you must not do certain things, but this part of you found itself excited by that, and it didn't change the inner man. And as long as the inner man is still filled with envy and selfishness and pride and all of those other things, it's not right. And the law couldn't fix that. And that's why Paul therefore says in verses 21 through 25 that this is what was wrong with the law. This is Paul's personal critique, as it were, of reliance on the law of Moses for justification. It is Paul's personal testimony. Paul is saying, I'm telling you that I used to live according to the law of Moses, and I'm telling you that it didn't change who I was. That I found myself being pulled in two directions. I wanted to do one thing, but my flesh wanted me to do the very opposite. And I knew that I shouldn't do it, but I did it anyway because the flesh had a hold on me that the law could not undo. And when you see it that way, you begin to understand why it is that the Jewish leaders behaved as they did toward Jesus. Because their religion had not changed who they were. They were living this kind of scam, as it were, this shell of an existence in which outwardly they were right, but inwardly, as Jesus so pointedly put his finger on more than one occasion, he said, inside, you're corrupt and you're impure and you're unholy. And if I may, therein stands the lesson for you and I of Romans chapter 7. When you hear the word gospel, what do you think of? When you hear the word Christianity, what do you think of? What is it to you? Is it a bunch of rules? Is it, well, I'm a Christian, therefore I can't do this? I'm a Christian, therefore I do this. And is that as far as your understanding of Christianity goes? Let me tell you, friends, that if Romans 7 says anything, it says that we must not turn the gospel of Jesus Christ into some kind of mere external law addressed to the flesh. And I, in my experience with other Christians, have seen this, and I'm sure you have as well. I've seen people who were frustrated to death as Christians, and they want to do right. And maybe they'll show up at the worship services for a while, and then you won't see them for a while. Then they'll show up again, and then you won't. They're hot and they're cold. They're hot and they're cold because they're being pulled in two different directions at the same time, just like Paul used to be. Why? Because their religion to them is something that only addresses their flesh. And they're trying to be holy people while on the inside they're unholy. And somebody has told them someplace that if you'll go to church and if you'll say prayers and if you'll sing songs, that that's what a Christian is. And yet they have inside them all kinds of sinful problems. And I'm telling you that if Christianity is nothing more than a set of do this and don't do that, if it's nothing more than a bunch of rules and things that we do externally, that we have yet to understand Christianity. And if that's the kind of Christianity we're going to practice, it's only going to make us frustrated like it made Paul frustrated. You can't live that way. And ultimately, you will quit. But even worse than that, that kind of understanding of Christianity denies the power of the gospel. Because what Paul said in Romans chapter 6 needs to be on our minds, that you have died with Christ, that you didn't sign up just for a different set of rules. Why would Jesus do away, I ask you, with the law of Moses only to replace it with something just like it? Does it make sense? No. Gospel's not like the law of Moses. The gospel is more. The gospel is greater. The gospel is more powerful. It has the ability to change what the law couldn't change. It has the ability to change the mind. It has the ability to change the heart. It has the ability to create a new spirit. And if we never come to that, then we have not understood Christianity, and yea, even worse, we have denied its power. That's why Paul said in chapter 3 that all have sinned, and therefore all need the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the Jews said, oh, we don't need it. We were righteous already. We had the law. Paul is saying in Romans chapter 7, the law didn't get you what you thought it did. It didn't fix the real problem. The Jews still needed the gospel to change the inner man. And so Paul summarizes in verses 21 through 25. He says, I find then the principle that evil is present in me. The evil that he's talking about there is this desire of the flesh to please itself. That the flesh's desire to reject the demand of God. And with this evil desire, there coexists an inner awareness that sin must be avoided and that good must be pursued. Evil is present in me, but I'm the one that wants to do good. I concur with the law of God in the inner man, but I see a different law in the members of my body waging war against the law of my mind. And here's the sad part, making me a prisoner of the law of sin which is in my members. A law that is addressed only to the flesh is never going to win, because the power of the flesh is stronger than that. And sin will use its perversion to use the law as a way of enticing for more sin, and in the end, sin and the flesh will win. And Paul says, that's what the law of Moses did for me. It put me in this situation of being bound by the flesh, even though I knew I shouldn't be, even though I didn't want to be. Such is the power of the flesh and of sin. And no system, whether we call it the law of Moses or whether it is our view of Christianity that simply juxtaposes those two things, can ever succeed in overcoming the power of sin. Because it takes more than that. To put it plainly, you can't just tell a sinner, stop sinning. You've got to make the sinner a different person. You've got to make the sinner the kind of person who doesn't want to sin. That's what the law couldn't do. That's what the gospel does. And the hint of the answer lies in verse 25. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord, which is Paul's way of talking about the gospel. How that works will be explained in chapter 8. We'll try to pick up with that the next time that we have opportunity to visit this text. But for now, thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. If you've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, and I'm not talking about gotten into a baptistry, I'm talking about dying so that who you used to be doesn't exist anymore, that you become a new person in Jesus. If you've not done that, we stand ready to help you to do that this evening. If you've already done that and you find that you have not lived in a way that is consistent with that living of a new life, we can help you, if we can, to be right with God by offering prayers on your behalf or encouraging you. If you're subject to the gospel, won't you come as we stand and sing this song together?